Arsenal for Democracy is freely available weekly at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple and Stitcher, and we're supported by some listeners at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy for $3 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stuntbird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, New York Island, the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 408, recorded on Sunday, January 16th, 2022. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
This week, we're talking about the Bracero Guest Worker Program of World War II. When the U.S. entered World War II at the end of 1941, American women were not the only people brought into the U.S. workforce to replace men leaving for military service. The Emergency Farm Labor Act of 1942 significantly increased foreign agricultural worker presence in the United States during the war, drawing most heavily from Mexico, which was still experiencing economic depression and which had declared war on the Axis powers in July 1942 and needed an easy way to contribute to the Allies and to patch things up with the US, UK, and other countries after a bumpy 1930s relationship. There was a need to replace some 5 million U.S. workers in short order, and this program was a way of covering about 10% of that gap. It came to be known as the Bracero Program in common parlance, from the Spanish for manual farm laborer in reference to a pair of arms, as they were providing extra arms to help with the farm work. Our main source, among many others, for this episode is the website for the Smithsonian Museum of American History's Bittersweet Harvest exhibit on the Bracero program, which closed in 2017. And also, if you want to learn more, the Bracero History Project, which is related, has recorded more than 600 oral histories and has collected many objects. The website www.braceroarchive.org provides online access to this collection of oral histories, photos, documents, and objects. That's quoting from the Smithsonian. To give some additional sort of context to how this was viewed officially, propaganda posters in support of the program depicted a white arm in Uncle Sam garb holding aloft the classic Uncle Sam hat next to a brown arm holding aloft a sombrero with bilingual captioning of "Americans all, let's fight for victory." Now, supposedly this was going to be a temporary guest worker program as part of the war effort. In October 1942, nearly 3 months after the agreement with the Mexican government was signed, FDR reported only 3,000 Mexican guest farm workers to the press. But the Bracero program ended up remaining in place until 1964, 22 years later, when the new wave of immigration restrictions were being enacted. During that span, about 2 million Mexican men participated in these short-term contracts to work in the United States at peak times, such as the harvest season. Originally, they were concentrated in California and then some other southwestern states. By the end, only a handful of states in the American South, New England, Appalachia, and for whatever reason, North Dakota, as well as obviously the isolated later states of Alaska and Hawaii, had not participated in using Bracero short-term farm labor. In addition to the exploitative but legal Bracero program guest worker admissions, there were also vastly more undocumented workers. Almost immediately, but also especially as the program went on, partly because the extremely short-term contracts were highly disruptive to the lives of the workers and their families for not very much money, and it often made more financial sense to overstay permission and keep working for a longer period, or simply to enter secretly in the first place. These unlawful workers were at constant risk of deportation, including by their own employers reporting them to get out of paying wages. For a comparative figure, in 1950, there were 70,000 lawful guest workers from Mexico and 500,000 deportations to Mexico. As we'll talk about later, Truman signed a reform in 1951, known by those in the industry as Public Law 78, meant to contain the escalating abuses, but instead it basically just codified the situation until 1968 and even expanded the size of the program, and we'll get back to that in a bit. Rachel, could you talk about at the beginning of the program, when this was originally signed between the U.S. and Mexico in 1942, what was supposedly on the table that was going to incentivize Mexicans to participate.
Yeah, according to the agreement between the U.S. and Mexican governments, workers were promised decent living conditions, sanitation, adequate shelter and food, and supposedly a minimum wage of 30 cents an hour, as well as protections from forced military service. And also, a guaranteed part of the wages were to be put into a private savings account in Mexico. Now, these promises were not always upheld, as we'll discuss later.
Yeah, well, really, almost all of them were broken in some way or another, as will be unsurprising to our listeners. Every state in Mexico sent workers under the program, at least over the full 22-year period. But let's talk a little bit about the beginning of the program. The Mexican government was in charge of recruiting the laborers and negotiating the terms with the U.S. government. Many high-level Mexican officials had a low opinion for rural Mexican peasants, which, as a sidebar here, I would say a lot of those would have been indigenous. That's still true today. I think that's important to underscore here, but that's not exclusively true. And certainly not all the participants were, but when we're talking about the rural peasantry, in many cases we are talking about that. So, as I said, the Mexican government, their top officials, including the president apparently, had this kind of negative opinion of rural Mexican peasants, and they hoped that the program might help improve the national workforce's development. Basically, send them to the U.S., they'll get a bit more skills, they'll get a bit more money, they'll get more experience with how American farming works. And of course, that didn't really work out that way because they were really just there to provide an extra pair of arms. There wasn't a real skill component. And as Rachel alluded to, the original plan was that they were going to deposit a portion of the wages directly to the personal accounts of these workers in Mexico's agricultural credit bank. And they might then draw upon this back home to purchase farming equipment. And this would then, therefore, technologically improve Mexico's farms. So that was another reason why the Mexican government thought this was a great idea. But in practice, a lot of this just simply did not work out that way. For one thing, workers often had to travel long distances to reach regional processing centers. And that was an expensive thing that sometimes required taking out loans. And then from there, they would be put on trains to the U.S. border. But the promise of remittance money to send back to family at home was, of course, a powerful lure. And it turned out it was not only a powerful lure for the Mexican peasants who were used to farming, but also for many of their rural middle-class striver neighbors as well. A day's pay in the U.S., however low and exploitative it was by American standards, was still worth a few weeks of pay in rural Mexico. It could be expensive to travel to processing, and processing center staff often demanded bribes to issue a card to participate. At the border, U.S. agents would strip the Mexican workers naked and spray them with DDT and give them a physical exam. Those who passed would be permitted to enter and were lined up against the wall, almost like an auction, for representatives of the grower companies. The American processing facilities had a large army of female typists to help with the record keeping. Sometimes workers would try to negotiate with the growers for assurances about their working conditions and treatment. But generally, they were compelled to sign whatever contracts were offered. And of course, once they had signed, then, you know, all bets are off. You don't have any leverage anymore. And so they would be shipped, often in cattle cars, hundreds or even thousands of miles from the borders, isolating them from meaningful safeguards. The Mexican consuls would periodically circulate monitors to participating farms where the workers lived temporarily, but they couldn't really help much if there were problems. I want to quote here from the Smithsonian exhibit. Bracero contracts promised much but did not always deliver. Poor housing conditions, disputes over pay, discrimination, inadequate health care, and a lack of worker representation were some of the Bracero's common grievances. Workers were sometimes housed in converted barns and makeshift tents with limited water, heat, and sanitary facilities. They were often transported in unsafe and poorly operated vehicles. Although the work was grueling and housing substandard, many Braceros endured these conditions, hoping to make more money than they would at home. American unions that had been trying to unionize agricultural workers before the war quickly became alarmed by the rapidly growing presence of low-cost foreign temporary labor in the industry. In fact, guest worker wages were supposed to be paid on a prevailing wage basis, but that basis was a self-reported lowball calculation provided to the U.S. government without verification, which effectively drove out local workers from the market, allowing growers to claim necessity to hire foreign migrants. Many of the future U.S. farm labor unions, including those primarily representing Mexican Americans, took a very hard line against immigration for generations as a result. United Farm Workers would be one such example of a union that had that perspective. They believed that local workers could no longer get hired at all because of the growers' reliance on cheaper foreign migrant labor. Some of the foreign workers' short-term contracts were for just a matter of weeks, but some were actually hired for a year and a half at a time. They were often paid in reality by quantity, not by the hour, and usually an equivalent to far, far less than a dollar per hour. During the wartime phase of the program, some braceros were also hired under separate legislation to maintain railroad tracks, often connected to the agricultural production, rather than to work directly in the fields. But this did not continue with the rest of the program after World War II ended. The program had a profound effect on American communities, particularly given how long it lasted. And quoting again from the exhibit, "The bracero program affected communities across the United States. Some towns held dances, church services in Spanish, and other social and business events for the braceros. Many braceros never returned to Mexico. Some of them developed personal relationships, married local women, and started new families in the United States. Other towns discriminated against the braceros, barring them from restaurants and movie theaters. Even some local Mexican Americans were wary of the new workers." End quote. Some places in the U.S. only had a handful of Mexican workers, and I mean really like there were farms that had, you know, less than 10 of the foreign migrant workers, but other farms employed about 1,000 at a time. And so this could really influence the composition of a community, either long term or during particular seasons of the year. Many communities that had segregation policies against black residents soon extended these same restrictions against Mexican workers. And in fact, the entire state of Texas was suspended from the program for a few years by the Mexican government during the war due to the lynchings of Mexican nationals.
So this was a really long program, over 22 years. So there really were kind of different phases to the program. During the wartime phase of the program, braceros participated in many work stoppages and strikes across the Northwest, protesting their low wages. These happened a lot in Idaho because the primary crop was sugar beets, and they're an extremely difficult crop to harvest. You have to get the beets out of the ground before the ground freezes, and it's just really, really hard labor, and these braceros were not making that much money. So there were frequent work stoppages and strikes across Idaho and Oregon and Washington. One notable strike in July 1943 in Dayton, Washington, demonstrated joint bracero-Japanese-American labor solidarity. So in addition to foreign labor, interned Japanese-Americans also supplied agricultural labor. So in this case in Dayton, Washington, a white woman reported an assault by an assailant who, quote-unquote, appeared Mexican. And so in response, the county officials restricted the movement of both braceros and Japanese workers from entering the residential areas of the city. And there was no investigation, and there was no questioning of any of the braceros or Japanese workers to try to ascertain the truth of the situation. And so after this restriction order was put in place, approximately 170 Mexicans and 230 Japanese struck, halting work at the Blue Mountain Cannery. So after many meetings among city officials, cannery management, and worker representatives, the restriction order was lifted, and ultimately the workers went back and finished their work on the pea harvest that season. So employers in the Northwest, unlike the Southwest, couldn't really use threats of deportation as an effective cudgel against workers. The distance and costs of deportation were much greater, so it just wasn't an effective threat. So the employers had to kind of create other means to depress wages. And so they created associations to unite the farm owners and keep wages low. And so in response, workers banded together to protest these low wages. And actually, Mexican consuls in Salt Lake City and Portland really encouraged these labor strikes and advocated for the braceros much more than they did in the Southwest. So as Bill mentioned earlier, the Mexican consuls had monitors kind of going around, inspecting the farms, inspecting the conditions. And there were just many fewer monitors in the Northwest versus the Southwest. So the only real means to protest low wages or bad conditions were to conduct these strikes and work stoppages. As we mentioned earlier, about 10% of the wages earned by braceros between 1942 and 1949 were withheld by U.S. farmers and sent by U.S. banks to Mexican banks. These forced savings often disappeared, and the Mexican government said it had no record of what happened to these forced savings. Several lawsuits were filed against the banks and the Mexican and U.S. governments to recoup the forced savings. Some remained pending, but the Mexican government created a fund to compensate braceros and their survivors with up to $3,500 if they could prove with pay stubs, work visas, labor contracts, or other documents that they worked in the U.S. between 1942 and 1964. So as Bill mentioned earlier, Truman's Public Law 78 tried to address illegal immigration, but it didn't include sanctions against employers who knowingly hired undocumented workers, which is a stipulation that the Mexican government was really trying to advocate for. So there really wasn't much of teeth in the enforcement against employers who were knowingly hiring these undocumented workers, exploiting them because they were undocumented and really had no means to redress their poor conditions and wages. These efforts continued throughout the 1950s, with the INS repatriating 3.8 million Mexican workers who overstayed their work contracts. This program operated while American labor organizations complained that undocumented workers hurt labor efforts and oppressed wages and benefits. In 1961, Kennedy signed an extension to Public Law 78, which guaranteed that all U.S. workers received the same benefits as the braceros, which, as we discussed, was not really a high bar to clear. And after this, bracero employment dropped significantly from 437,000 workers in 1959 to 186,000 in 1963. In 1963, the House of Representatives rejected an extension of the program. However, the Senate approved an extension that required U.S. workers to receive the same non-wage benefits as braceros. The House responded with a final one-year extension of the program without the non-wage benefits, and the bracero program finally ended in 1964. And I really wanted to highlight the fact that employers were never really targeted for their part in hiring undocumented workers. So a lot of the laws were targeting the workers themselves. I'm assuming this is because these employers had a lot of power, a lot of lobbying money, and so they could kind of sidestep this issue, which still exists to this day. A lot of the laws regarding undocumented workers really targets the workers themselves and not the farms or like the poultry processing plants that are the biggest offenders in hiring undocumented workers. So as kind of a humorous coda to the end of the program in 1964, after the 1964 termination of the bracero program, the A-Team, or Athletes in Temporary Employment as Agricultural Manpower program of 1965, was meant to simultaneously deal with the resulting shortage of farm workers and a shortage of summer jobs for teenagers. More than 18,000 17-year-old high school students were recruited to work on farms in Texas and California. Only 3,300 ever worked in the fields, and many of them quickly quit or staged strikes because of the poor working conditions, including oppressive heat and decrepit housing. The program was canceled after the first summer. And this was from the Wikipedia article on the bracero program.
So I wanted to make some other stray observations and discussion points before we close this episode out. One thing is that you might have heard recently, there was a whole Guardian article in December 2021 about this, just a few weeks ago, about the U.S. investigation that found, and I guess prosecuted, human traffickers. I mean, not in the sense that you might be thinking, but in, you know, the very sort of corporatized sense. There was a $200 million scheme to bring workers illegally into the United States to perform farm labor work under duress for literally no pay or pennies at best. Some of the rates they were paying the workers, if they were paid, were the same in nominal dollars and cents as what bracero workers were getting paid in the 40s, 50s, and 60s with no adjustment for inflation. We're talking about tens of cents at best, and that was if they actually got paid at all. In many cases, they would do a bunch of picking, and then the company would be like, bye, go away, and that would be it, and they would have no recourse. And that's sort of like just one recent example, because this is something that happens all the time. And that brings me to sort of a broader point, which I wanted to discuss with you, Rachel. Bernie Sanders was criticized a lot in the last two presidential elections for the fact that he had voted against a proposed immigration reform package during the Bush administration. And the reason that he gave was always the same every time, which is that he opposed guest worker programs because he believed that they were inherently extremely exploitative and abusive to the people working under them. He was attacked as being anti-immigrant for having opposed this legislation. We, of course, know what guest worker programs in, like, Gulf countries look like, too, and that's pretty bad. But we have this example from the Bracero program right here at home about exactly what happens with these type of guest worker programs. And there are other guest worker programs that exist as well currently in the United States. And it's just, you know, it's just incredibly abusive. Low paid, there's very limited protections if there's some problem happening on the work site. You have no real sort of organized labor power. And it's just generally not a good situation for the people who are in it. Now, as we've talked about with throughout this, people still come anyway, right? I mean, partly they might be tricked, but partly they just decide to put up with these horrible conditions because they are going to make more money than they would make at home. And that is not ideal, essentially. We shouldn't just allow that because they're willing to come. We should be trying to look out for the interests of every worker that's here, including foreign workers. So if we're going to have foreign workers, whether they're temporary or long term, they should have incredible levels of protection, monitoring, and safeguards, and not just be sort of at the whims of whatever contracting employer they work for. And that's the other problem, too, is that if they are coming here under a specific arrangement with a specific company that is incredibly vulnerable for the workers, as opposed to a situation where they could, you know, supposedly anyway, you know, in the marketplace, go and find another job if they didn't like the conditions or pay at the job that they were at. And you can't do that when you have a program like this. You also can't do it if the various growers and other companies that are benefiting from this labor are working together in cartels. So, Rachel, I wanted to get your thoughts on some of this. I think that a lot of times we don't think of the U.S. as having those type of abusive guest worker programs. And in fact, we did and still do.
Yeah, it's also used as a way to break labor solidarity. Like the unions can't really get a foothold if there's a whole bunch of undocumented workers that are scared to speak out about their conditions because they know they'll be retaliated against and oftentimes deported or threatened in other ways. It's just another way of getting around labor organizing and breaking union efforts. I know we were talking about doing an episode about the United Farm Workers, but it's kind of hard to have that nuanced discussion where these workers were against guest worker legislation and kind of anti-immigrant labor because these workers were being used to break up the union efforts and being used to as replacement workers, even though I think there was a provision in the law saying they couldn't be used as replacement workers, but obviously there were ways to get around that and get around labor strikes and labor organizing. So it's hard to have that nuanced discussion, but I think with the background of the Bracero program, that kind of lays that informational foundation so we can have that nuanced discussion as to why somebody would be opposed to guest worker legislation without disparaging their motives.
So the only other thing that I wanted to comment about, because I couldn't really figure out where to fit this in, and it's sort of been alluded to here and there earlier in our narrative, but the Bracero program during World War II was far from the only wartime labor replacement program in agriculture. In less backbreaking roles, women and high school students were indeed recruited, as well as some older men who were unfit for military service. They would be assigned to help with farms. But as Rachel said, perhaps most controversially, aside from the Bracero guest worker program itself, was the use of interned Japanese Americans in places like Montana. And many of these interned Japanese workers had in fact been, wait for it, farm workers to begin with before their internment. And I thought that was sort of an interesting angle that I had known a little bit about, but not really to this extent.
Yeah, it's kind of part, it's an ugly part of Idaho history, but we also had some camps in our state. And yeah, that is largely what Japanese Americans were doing before their internment. So it's kind of, they were often owners of farms too, and they had their land taken away from them, and they were interned and then forced to go work on other people's farms, which just seems to add great insult to great injury.
All right. Well, Rachel, I think we've gotten a little bit more information this week on a program that we were only vaguely familiar at best with, which is the Bracero Guest Worker Program implemented during World War II and then continued to the 1960s. Thanks for coming on this week to talk about it with me.
Thanks. It was a fascinating topic this week.